This conference is being recorded.
Hello, everybody. This is Lance Weiler, and you're listening to another edition of This Conference is Being Recorded, brought to you by the Workbook Project, and special thanks to our sponsor, Without a Box. Today, we're joined by J.T. Petty, who is an excellent writer, director, very prolific, and has kind of crossed from film into games into books. Thanks so much for joining us today, JT.
Thank you, Lance.
Usually what we kind of start out with is just a little bit of a background.
Sure. So software digging was my thesis project at NYU, undergrad. So, you know, you make a movie that's usually 20 or 30 minutes long. It's kind of the culmination of your time at film school. And the one I made turned out to be a feature. And I guess this was in 1998, and we had it finished on video pretty quickly, but was making it entirely with my own money. You know, so we shot the thing for about $6,000, and then I was just sort of eating potatoes for a couple of years trying to save up the money to make print so I could take it to festivals. And while I was doing that, I started doing video game jobs. And had some success with that. I mean, I did a Batman game and a Tarzan game. And then the first original thing I did was this game called Splinter Cell that turned out to get a pretty good following, and I wrote a couple of those games. And I got pretty firmly enmeshed in that, and then in 2001, software digging went to Sundance. And I did a bunch of festivals with that movie, and that ended up getting me further jobs in writing and directing for movie work.
In terms of software digging, it's an interesting movie, very sparse in terms of dialogue. It's almost a silent film, but was that a limitation that you were dealing with in terms of the gear that you had, or was it a stylistic choice?
I mean, the lack of dialogue in software digging, and then I guess I want to call it a non-talkie instead of a silent film, because it is a really intensely sound-designed movie. That was basically the genesis of the movie, was the idea of doing a silent film. But the idea of doing a movie without dialogue, because it just seems like it's a very film school-y thing to do. It's kind of like, you know, a challenge that you set yourself. But it's also all of my favorite movies. You can kind of turn the subtitles off and you still know exactly what's going on. You know, like you can watch The Road Warrior in Dutch and it's the exact same movie and you know who all the characters are and why they're making those choices. You know, I was obviously always a huge fan of the sort of pre-dialogue films. You know, Buster Keaton's one of my heroes, and Wampier and all the Dreiser and stuff. Like, there was so much creativity and energy in movies when they had to do everything visually. And I sort of wanted to copy some of that. On top of that, I mean, just the fact, again, that we did have a very limited budget, shooting everything without sound did mean that we could go a whole lot faster and did mean that I could control things a lot more easily. I mean, that was sort of the first, you know, real long, it was the first feature movie I was directing, and I wanted to make sure I was getting these performances out of actors who, a lot of them, you know, was the first movie that they had acted in. And because we were shooting without sound, it meant that I could crouch by the camera and just basically talk their internal monologue to them, sort of a lot like directors would do back in the teens and the 20s. So no, I mean, it certainly helped with the economics, but it was primarily a creative decision.
And the storyline for the film, could you speak to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Software Digging is basically a ghost story about an old man who lives alone in the woods and one day goes out searching for his runaway cat and stumbles across this sort of terrible murder. And then once, you know, he goes to the authorities, you know, tries to convince them this thing happened, but there's no body and there's no corpse. There's no evidence that anything was committed. So everybody thinks he's just this crazy old man. And he eventually, you know, sort of starts to break down over that, and there's a little ambiguity about whether he's being haunted or if he's going crazy. And it's basically his journey to find the truth. I mean, it plays with a lot of the horror movie tropes. I mean, it's kind of become a cliche in movies, you know, that you've seen something terrible and nobody believes you. So you're like, oh, just go back to babysitting the kids. It's going to be fine. And making it a horror movie and following all of those was also part of of making this movie without dialogue, because suddenly everybody basically knows what's going to happen in a horror movie. You know, they know the basic beats of it. And as long as I stayed kind of within that framework and found interesting ways to subvert it, you know, I didn't need all these expositionary scenes where people are explaining, you know, why they don't believe the crazy old man in the woods, because, you know, he's the crazy old guy in the woods.
And I think this is an interesting transition when I kind of look at what you're, you know, how that path worked for you, because typically people will finish up a film like a movie like Soft for Digging, which is, you know, in your case, like a thesis film that kind of expands itself and becomes, you know, feature length, and they kind of take it out on the festival circuit, and maybe they hope to kind of jump in and do larger budgeted work or feature work. And you kind of take this interesting step into a totally different arena, you know, with gaming, and actually step right in and start writing these games. You know, I guess what led to that? Was it something where you were actively a gamer? Was it by chance?
I mean, that was a fair amount of chance. I mean, basically, the story is that I was PAing on movies. So, you know, I was driving trucks and fetching coffee and stuff and editing Soft for Digging at night. So, you know, and when you're a PA, you're working 6 14-hour days a week. And I would, like, you know, put in my 14-hour day, and then I'd go to the editing room, and I'd, you know, cut sound for 3 hours and then sleep for 3 hours, then go back to set. And it just made me into a really, really terrible PA. I was, like, crashing trucks and stuff because I was exhausted all the time. So I wanted to go get a day job that would be 8 or 9 hours in an office. And Ubisoft, this software company, was taking applications for a receptionist. So I filled out my resume and went to Ubisoft. And when I got into the office, there was a pile of resumes for receptionists and a pile of resumes for screenwriters. And I was literally just like, you know, I don't want to answer the phone. So I put my resume on that one, on that pile. So it was, I mean, kind of largely chance. There was 13, I think, interviews with different people in the company. It was a really long interview process to actually then get the job of screenwriting. But finding it was sheer luck. And I always played video games. I hadn't played in a couple of years before getting that job, simply out of probably poverty more than anything else. But, you know, I mean, I always sort of was part of that. And this was right when the PlayStation 2 was a couple months away from coming out. So it was the first time that there was enough memory in a game system that you would actually have extensive dialogue, and cutscenes would suddenly become a major part of, you know, what you're doing in a video game. You know, Metal Gear Solid was just about to come out. So the idea of a video game screenwriter was still new enough that somebody like me could essentially BS their way into the job.
And when you're doing that, maybe you could speak to, because I'm kind of fascinated by this, you know, obviously what it is to write a film, but how is that different in terms of a game? Are you actually putting together what you usually will do for television, which is like a show bible? Are you doing a similar thing and creating this world? How does that process work in terms of writing for video games?
Yeah, I mean, every video game writing job is drastically different. I mean, and obviously just from the shape of games. Like, if you're going to write Grand Theft Auto versus writing Katamari Damacy, that's, you know, apples and something that's not even fruit. It's like apples and Sharpie pens. The first step, I guess, is you decide. Well, the first step for any game I've ever done, especially if it's going to be any kind of original world, is basically the equivalent of a show bible. So, for example, on Splinter Cell, that was like a 90-page document that just outlined who these characters were, the universe, the style, the tone, who the enemies are, what the basic structure of the story is, how the story is going to be told. I mean, there's always so much to define. I mean, it's not nearly as set as a TV job or a film job where they've been making these stories for 100 years, and there's a firm knowledge of how to do it. So the first thing I usually do in a game after we have this mission bible, or I'm sorry, the sort of world bible, is actually creating a format for that script. Because if you're going to do something that you know, the story isn't interrupting gameplay with a miniature movie that's going to tell you the story. You know, because they call those cinematics, and cinematics I think are just boring. You know, it's sort of like breaking into a radio play in the middle of your film. You're not really using the medium to its full advantage. So, I mean, there's no real one set way to do it. And I think, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of a tough question. And I think a lot of writers who start in film and TV have trouble moving over into video games because they want to follow some kind of specific format where it's this medium that we're still learning how to tell a story in. And it can be drastically different.
Have you seen anything that you're taking from that experience and applying to some of the other, you know, narrative screenwriting that you're doing for film?
I think writing for video games made me probably much more disciplined and much more efficient. Because, like, the Splinter Cell script for the first one was, you know, if you put that into a standard movie script format, that would probably approach 1,000 pages because you have this 15 to 20 hour experience that somebody's playing through that has people talking most of the time, and you have to account for all the different things that a player can do. So to write that much dialogue, I mean, I sort of had to force myself just to, like, sit down in the office every morning at 8 and write until 6. And of course, because we're sort of making up how to tell that story as we go along, you know, just because the technology is so new, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that you're throwing out and rewriting and just refiguring. And then in terms of efficiency, writing in video games, I was always really conscious that people didn't want to sit there and listen to my dialogue. They wanted to play the game. So I had to constantly be earning their attention and earning their respect, but at the same time being as brief as possible. You know, a lot of the stuff I'd go back and look to for inspiration was a lot of, like, the hard-boiled novels, like, you know, James Cain and Dashiell Hammett and stuff. Like, they were so remarkable at almost creating this language for expressing themselves as quickly as possible. And I think that's why you see so much noirish kind of dialogue all over movies now, not just in noir, but everywhere, because that kind of the hard-boiled patter is so good for getting a lot of information across fast.
When you were kind of working on the games, you had an opportunity to do a larger budgeted film, which was in the Mimic series. How did that come about for you? Because obviously you go from Soft for Digging, which is a small, you know, kind of budgeted film, you know, virtually no dialogue, some writing within a couple of the video games, and then all of a sudden you're doing effectively a studio type picture, you know, with more resources. What was that experience like?
So I got the job because of a producer that I met at Sundance who saw Soft for Digging, and he worked at Dimension and brought me in to meet all of the executives there. And basically, I think it worked. They hired me originally as a writer on it. And when I started, I think I actually got that job before Splinter Cell came out, so I didn't really have that to go on. And mostly, I think I got that job by pitching it and by writing them a treatment. You know, and I came into the room, and they told me all of the sequels that they were making, which I think is where Dimension sort of wanted to start people out. And I think what appealed to me mostly about Mimic was they had this concept of doing Rear Window with giant cockroaches, which I think for the license is actually a really pretty brilliant idea, because the monster in Mimic, I don't know if are you familiar with the Mimic series?
Yeah, yes, I am.
I mean, you know, it's a fairly goofy concept that, like, this cockroach, when it's standing on its hind legs from a distance, if you sort of squint, kind of looks like a guy in a trench coat. But if you're, you know, a sickly guy in the eighth story of an apartment who can't leave and is looking at figures down in the courtyard, then the monster kind of starts to make sense. And really, I mean, they were really good about, you know, and there were certainly some concessions that I had to make making a studio movie. And that was new, and that was certainly something that I kind of learned about through that process. I mean, Mimic, if nothing else, was just a giant learning process for me. Because, again, like Software Digging, I made with, you know, seven friends essentially in my backyard and no money. And then on Mimic, I suddenly have, you know, a crew of 80 people who are good at their jobs and can make whatever you want. But you have to be able to sort of manage them and the studio's input and all of that stuff much differently.
And you guys ended up shooting that over in Europe, right, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, we shot in Romania. So it was a lot of, probably the most work on the film was trying to make Romania look like Queens, which, you know, I don't know if we fully succeeded in, but got kind of close to. Romania was a funny experience because they're really good at shooting movies because they shoot a lot of movies over there because it's very cheap to do. So anytime, you know, when I say, you know, here we need somebody who gets attacked by a giant cockroach from above and lifted off the ground and then shotgunned to death and then set on fire. And, like, that's no problem. And then I would say in this scene somebody's eating a grilled cheese sandwich. And, you know, the props person would show up with, you know, this, like, 2-foot-long loaf of bread and a wheel of cheese. You'd be like, no, 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 you know, and it would take, you know, 3 or 4 iterations of the prop guy trying to make a grilled cheese sandwich before you could get one, which is sort of the funniest thing there. It's like anything big and seemingly expensive and cinematic was really easy, but all of the tiny details about what American culture is like took a whole lot of doing.
From script to screen, that was a pretty fast process for you, wasn't it? I mean, I think when we had talked about it before, they kind of brought you in. You had to write the draft, you know, write the script relatively quickly, and then you found yourself in Romania and you were shooting, and then it seemed like it was a very compressed schedule.
Yeah, it was totally compressed. I mean, I think at the time Dimension was going to shoot, it was like 6 horror sequels back-to-back. I mean, when I went in for the meeting, you know, they basically say to me, we're making Children of the Corn 10, we're making The Prophecy 4 and 5, we're making Mimic 3, we're making Hellraiser 8 and 9, and we're making Highlander 7. Which of those do you want to do? You know, so I choose Mimic. They trigger me on writing the script. And I think I was originally scheduled to shoot second in line, because they were going to shoot all of those movies back-to-back. But when everybody turned in their drafts, I think my draft was the closest to shootable. So they bumped me up to go in first, which meant that, you know, 2 weeks from turning in the draft, I had to jump on a plane and go to Romania to start 4 weeks of pre-production before we shot for 4 weeks. You know, I think start to finish, it was something like 6 months, you know, where it went from a one-sentence concept to a film that was shot, edited, scored, you know, just ready to be released on video.
Now, when you were in that situation, because obviously, you know, when you were talking about Software Digging and directing in that context, it was very similar to, you know, kind of giving the direction from right near the camera and talking somebody through what they were doing. What was it like adjusting to directing, you know, the actors that you had? Who are obviously there's a great cast that you have there. How did you go about that? Was there a rehearsal period? What was the approach that you took?
We did have a rehearsal period. I mean, again, Mimic was just like a learning process the whole way through, and I was crazy fortunate on the cast, I think, to get the guys that we did, because it was such a bunch of different approaches to being an actor. I mean, the lead guy, Carl Geary, you know, who'd been in a lot of Michael Almereyda stuff, and he shows up in art films all the time, is like total process kind of actor and wants to spend the week before shooting, you know, rehearsing all the time, talking with you about where the character's coming from, you know, just really, really putting together a solid motivation for the guy so that, you know, by the end of the first week of shooting, he just knew exactly who Marvin was, and he could usually do the scene, you know, within a few steps of what we were aiming at, and then just shape him from there. And then, you know, Amanda Plummer, who I just, you know, like, absolutely adore. I mean, and you know, just her stuff in Pulp Fiction, the stuff, I don't know if you ever saw a movie called Butterfly Kiss. like an amazing performance from her. So good. But she was so good at bringing something new to every take. Like you could kind of direct her, but she was also constantly just a little bit out of your control, which I ended up actually loving because it would keep everybody on set on their toes. Like none of the actors ever just got into rotely performing their lines. You know, and then Lance Henriksen is sort of the exact opposite of that. Like he's such a professional about it. Like he's there to do the job. He's there to speak the lines, and he knows who Lance Henriksen is. You know, and it's sort of you shape the Lance into whatever version of Lance you're going to get. And of course, Alexis Ziena is also just great and so much energy. So I mean, it's sort of like one of those things of you kind of I think on any movie you try to get the actors to adapt to your style some, but really you try to learn who they are and use that. I don't know. And like you said, I was just really lucky with the cast that we ended up getting.
Now, when you're doing that, did you, because there's obviously a couple different styles there of acting or approaches. Did you have any situations where, you know, you would go into a scene and somebody would effectively start to, you know, somebody was, they could get it in one or two takes, and then somebody else maybe needed a couple more to kind of get into a rhythm of the scene? Did you have anything that you had to deal with in those terms?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, people had good and bad days. And also on a movie like Mimic, you don't have a lot of time to mess around. Because it is sort of, you know, you're dealing with monsters and special effects and pyrotechnics, but you're shooting in Romania with half as many days as you should have to shoot the story. So it was always sort of a, you know, it was a constant sort of struggle between getting exactly what you want and getting enough coverage to actually, you know, cut the scene together. Again, most of them within a couple weeks, you know, which again is like half of the shoot, but like they understood who the characters were. And I think a lot of the time it's just, it's funny. I mean, you always hear directors talking about like on set, if you get 30% of what you're hoping for, like you're golden. And I think that's kind of true. And all of the real power of controlling what a performance is and controlling what the movie is actually ends up being in the editing room.
Your newest project, which is Sandman, and you're kind of once again kind of mixing it up and coming into it's kind of a documentary, and you know, you're kind of trying a new form with it. And can you walk us through you know, the process for Sandman and maybe give the listeners kind of an overview of what it is? I know it kind of goes into the underground of horror, but.
Yeah, I mean, Sandman's basically about underground horror and voyeurism and violence in media. Like, I just think that we're in a crazy, crazy interesting time in terms of watching violence. That, you know, now, you know, I think yours and my generation was probably the first one with easy access to pornography, and the current generation has easy access to absolutely anything. Like, I don't know what percentage of 12-year-olds in the world saw Saddam Hussein die. You know, and that's such a weird statement to be able to make. But it's just so easy to see that kind of stuff. So I you know, basically wanted to make a documentary about that subject, about watching violence. And the angle that I took on it is basically through these underground horror guys, which is a world I got into from doing the horror conventions and from having software digging out in the world and doing film festivals and stuff. And the fact that it was this kind of zero-budget movie that, you know, had you know, some success and a lot of exposure, I would get contacted by underground horror guys who were looking for advice on their movie or just wanted to share movies. You know, it was like a video trade kind of a thing. And, you know, so it's movies that people are shooting for a couple hundred or a couple thousand bucks with friends in their backyard. And more often than not, you know, they're totally maudlin, and they would be sort of, you know, raspberry blood and fake tits and all that stuff, and there's, you know, it's, you know, embarrassing to watch. But then every once in a while, you get something and you look at it, and you suddenly, there's all this, always this question of what's real and what's not when you're watching one of these films. You know, you see a special effect that is too good for anything they could have actually done, and you realize that somebody has actually cut themselves or is you know, this is a real fight, or it's unclear whether or not somebody who they're filming knows they're being filmed. I mean, just like all of these sort of little games that the people are playing inside the movie to make it scary without money. And for me, that just calls up a lot of sort of interesting ideas. And to be honest, it also just made me scared again when I was watching movies in a way that I haven't been for such a long time. I mean, most of the horror film fans I know haven't really felt scared in a long time watching a movie. You know, you have these sort of little twinges of it. You see a really solid horror movie like The Descent or something, and it's almost this kind of, there's a level of removal between the fear you're feeling and your knowledge of enjoying that fear. But when I was watching an underground horror film and was actually concerned that at any moment I might actually see, you know, I might stumble onto a snuff film or whatever, there was actually still a little twinge of real fear there. So a lot of what I'm trying to do in Sandman is look at those kind of movies and eventually let it kind of almost become one of those movies where it recreates that sense of dread.
Sandman has been, you know, it was on the festival circuit. It had some great play in a number of places. What's next for it? How can people kind of track it down and see it? What are your plans to in terms of distribution for it?
Well, the movie was made by HDNet Films, who's tied into Magnolia. And I think Magnolia is kind of scared of the film because it does deal in fairly dark subject matter. So its future is kind of uncertain right now. We're still doing festivals. It'll be at Fantasia this summer, a couple others. But we're trying to figure that out. I mean, I think that's why you and I started talking recently, because I like what you did with Head Trauma. And I think it's actually, for a movie as specific as Sandman, a really interesting way to think about getting it into the world.
Yeah, so there might be kind of a hybrid approach that you take for it, I guess, in terms of the releasing of it.
I mean, my ideal would be to find some kind of home partner, you know, VOD or DVD or something, that would actually be the premiere of it, and then using a theatrical push, essentially, just to garner attention for that. But we're still... Right. We're still trying to feel that out.
In terms of future projects, what are you currently working on?
Let's see. I did some work on the video game adaptation of the Iron Man movie that Jon Favreau is making. And my fourth kids book comes out this summer. It's called The Scrivener Bees. It's the third Clemency Pogue book. And then this summer I'm going to go into production on The Burrowers, which is my horror western that I'm shooting for Lionsgate.
In closing, JT, I was wondering, do you have any words of advice, anything for, you know, the listeners out there who are thinking about making their own work or going through it at all different levels? Is there anything that kind of jumps to mind, something that you've come to learn, you know, a pitfall that maybe you can help them to avoid?
I don't know. I mean, I just say work all the time and expect to get kicked. Like, I do tend to get a lot of material into the world, but, you know, that's probably a fifth of the material that I'm actually working on. You know, and any entertainment job is going to be constant rejection, I think. So just, you know, expect a tough row, but... which I guess isn't the most encouraging advice, but it's probably better than having a job.
Well, JT, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today and sharing some insights into the process, and wish you the best with your upcoming projects and with the distribution of Sandman, and thanks a lot.
Yeah, and thank you.